I never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the Scan On Podcast, your weekly podcast looking at film news, Irish and international. I'm Darren, and joining me are
Jason,
Alex,
Ronan.
So we're going to talk about the usual. We're going to talk about film news. We're going to talk about the top 10 and the new releases. But let's start with what we normally do. So Jay, what have you watched since last we talked?
Okay. Thank you, Letterboxd, for going down when I look for my films. So, you know, I'm going to wing this one. None of my meticulous preparation as used. But I'll start off with The Greatest Showman.
Oh,
after 12 years of cinema, I finally saw it.
Still probably screening in the Savoy.
Did you see it in the Savoy?
I didn't. I saw it at home. And this is a strange, strange film. It's kind of not good, but kind of great.
Yeah.
Barnum, by all accounts, wasn't a nice guy. And any reading of it is quite clear that's the case. You don't touch that here, really, at all.
He's not nice, but he's not nice in the way that, you know, white guy protagonists in musicals are allowed to
He's
be.
He's fine.
Not nice.
He gets a bit angry and he apologizes eventually.
Yeah, and he learns his
lesson. The way that arc will...
thing is that, like, the people he offended and hurt, the disenfranchised people, accept his apology and he can continue to be great.
Mm. But what it does do, and what I kind of liked about it, it's a very inclusive cast, which is good in terms of...
Yes, even if they are all very supporting.
Very supporting. But that's the role. This is
the film
cell.
That we're in. Yeah.
And what he kind of do as well, which I kind of liked, is the... kind of abandoned Barnum's character for two or three kind of sections of the film and kind of concentrate on stories around it, which works, because they're much more interesting stories than Barnum's, quite frankly. And so, and the songs are terrific, they really are. It bounds along when the singing starts. Once it gets to the main bit and it's Barnum doing the thing and will this work and will the romance work, it's kind of, you know, the usual, and it's a bit kind of, ooh, look at this great white
energy.
Guy.
Well, it's also,
it
has energy, it has band, it's got wonderful production design, set design.
Yeah.
It's very
well
made.
Put together. I know, I realized, I enjoyed it when I watched it, but there was a niggling feeling with it
it's one of those movies we don't really make anymore.
No,
and there's maybe a reason why we don't.
I think
but
so.
At the same time, there's a certain nostalgic thrill to it.
But the songs are great, and I was kind of toe tapping in the way that I imagine millions of people were in the Savoy over the last 6 or 7 years.
So sing along version?
I wouldn't rule it out. I'm going to a lot of sing along versions of stuff, aren't I?
Yeah.
Oh, good lord. Okay.
This is all ahead of you.
Stop with that smile, Ron. But we'll leave
more
that
on that later.
In the context of Neil Simon, who died this week, I would have been a big fan growing up, particularly. I watched a lot of his stuff. And it's kind of funny when you say it's a lot of his stuff, because obviously stuff is kind of Neil Simon's The Odd Couple or whatever, and despite who directs it, it doesn't really matter. They're Neil Simon's
productions.
He was, and very much so. So, I would have watched a lot of his stuff, Biloxi Blues, The Odd Couple, The Out of Towners, all the kind of really great, great stuff over the years. But I decided to watch one that I hadn't seen before, inexplicably, but I hadn't seen, so I watched The Goodbye Girl, which is the Herbert Ross film of Simon's script with Richard Dreyfuss, and I think it's Marcia Mason. I think it was Neil Simon was married at the time. In this kind of a classic kind of set up romantic comedy, and it's kind of glorious. It's a wonderful kind of 70s film in the way that not all 70s films have to be miserable in the kind of, you know... New Hollywood kind of way. And Rocky kind of plays into that, even though that's a bit kind of grim as well. It is grim, but it's never considered in the kind of New Hollywood canon the way, say, Taxi Driver would be or, you know, that kind of stuff.
I may have had a discussion about somebody about the New Hollywood canon recently, and the Wikipedia page on New Hollywood is a fascinating read.
Really?
Let me just tell you that.
Oh, okay.
Classics such as Planet of the Apes are in there, and which I wouldn't have considered myself part of the New Hollywood movement.
And people tend to delineate it by year a lot of the time now. It's a complicated thing to unpack. There are people who include 2001 in there, which doesn't.
Yeah. I always thought it was generally kind of a Bonnie and Clyde onwards.
Yeah,
that would have been my
assumption as
well.
But some people take it that anything produced in America beyond that.
Wasn't it terrible musicals that everything produced that caused absolute fortunes of Dr. Doolittle or whatever, that probably aren't necessarily. But anyway.
Rocky is part of the Wikipedia.
But it should be, though. Yeah. I think.
It's a gritty, earthy cinema.
But it's really good.
Yes.
I like Rocky. But anyway, The Good Boy Girl is a kind of a lighter kind of in that territory kind of stuff. But it's really great. Dreyfuss and Mason play off each other brilliant. It's a wonderful structure in that way that only a really sharp playwright can kind of meticulously put it together. You know, it's like everything, it works right. The set has a kind of play-esque kind of department. You've seen it, that set in, it's great. Like the rooms cross the one small and the other, you can get past people, all that kind of stuff. And so it's great, little farcical kind of scenes can play out in it. And it has that kind of great, they hate each other first, but eventually they kind of fall in love kind of scenario. And that's fine. All that, once you do that well, it's great. And they do it very well here. It's a couple of things. The script is fantastic. And the finale has this kind of really dazzling kind of hopeful bit at the end, which is great. And it's not one of those things that feels tacked on. It's natural to the whole story. But there's one thing, and it's kind of funny. I didn't really kind of, when I was kind of tweeting about it, I didn't mention, but there's kind of like, if we look at everything through the 2018 lens of kind of what you would film or you wouldn't film now, there's kind of this whole scene where Dreyfuss kind of comes into the bathroom in the apartment and locks it and hides the key and basically tries to be romantic with Mason for several minutes in a really forceful way that we're cute in the 70s for some reason, wouldn't get past that.
Oh, yeah. No,
which is, I'm intrigued by it. Like, I'm not kind of, you know, the film's the film.
That's far from the worst thing to come out of New Hollywood.
No, absolutely. But it's just, I'm always fascinated when I look back at particularly films I haven't seen before or films I haven't revisited in quite some time. It's just fascinating to see how these things played out.
Things of the time that would have been the height of comedy.
From. And Dreyfuss play goes full Dreyfuss this, you know, that kind exuberant is the kind of term. But he's great. He won an Oscar for it as well. But I really, really liked it. It's a fantastic film. And it's kind of great 90 kind of minutes or 100 minutes of your time, should you want to do it. And the other one I'll mention before I pass on to somebody else is Eden Lake.
Interesting.
Which people have been telling me to watch on and off for years.
It's very popular.
Because really Fassbender is Kelly Riley and Jack O'Connell and all that kind of. It's like, what a young cast.
For listeners, Alex is wincing.
I hated it.
Oh, well, me too. Interestingly, that's interesting because people seemed. I always thought people seemed to love it. People used to keep telling me to watch it. It's amazing. It's got this. And it's really interesting in the sense that it has this kind of Straw Dogs kind of update for this kind of, you know, early 2000s or whatever it was. And
speaking of things you could do in the 70s and can't do now.
Yeah, indeed. But the film, like, it's extremely violent and intense, and it has a really excellent Kelly Riley who pretty much anchors the whole thing and holds it together. And Jack O'Connell being feral in the way that a young teenage intense guy can be. And it's like, yeah, okay, first 20 minutes in, it's like, oh, we'll see where this goes. But it's horrid, though. Its hatred for the working class is appalling. I mean, we're ever about work-class representations of characters or any kind of representations of groups or whatever is one thing or the other. This feels like a filmmaker saying that these people are horrible, as opposed to this feels like a kind of an attack at a particular political time.
They're explicitly pitched as a demonic other with no redemption.
They're not even people.
The ending is particularly important. Not to get into the details of it, but it really is like, oh, good God.
And it tries to pull this whole kind of, you know, oh, yeah, it's cyclical and stuff. But it doesn't have anything to say except they're all bastards, no matter which generation you find them from. Yeah. And, like, absolutely. You know, I mean, we'll beat you to the minute you're alive. Like.
Part of me sort of wonders, is that not just, again, stuff you could do in the 70s and can't do now? You look at the treatment of people in rural America in horror films.
Hang on, this
for
is
example.
Eden Lake. Is I know, the 70s, though.
I know, that's what I'm saying. It's taking that trope. Like, it's very much taking that idea.
But there's no
years. I know.
No, I understand that. Like, if you can do all of this if you want and if you so desire, if you're trying to say something with it. But for me, if all you're saying is these people are the scum of the earth, kind of underlying. I'm not saying you're saying that. What I'm saying is, if you're.
Darren hates working class people.
Podcast. Yeah.
But if you've no underlying thesis beyond that, what is the point of that
I agree. It's something that somebody definitely should have looked at before making the film or during the making the film.
Yeah.
But I remember watching it and thinking that it was very much an update of the Deliverance style approach to horror.
Oh, it is. It is a 70s horror kind of transformed to this thing. The politics is committed.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And my feeling watching it is, how it's shot, particularly, expresses a disdain.
And well, it's there from minute one. As you put it, demonic and monstrous.
Yeah, but it's there from minute one. Like, it's like when you pull up outside this kind of a... It's the Eden Lake kind of homes, you know, that they're going to be built and stuff. So, you know, you're getting there and it's like, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if we could have all these lovely gated community types to keep the others away? Yeah. Like, I mean, it starts off straight away and it pitches its tent exactly like that. And that's fine if you've got something to say with that. If you're being... You have a kind of intelligent debate going on within your film, and it can be done. That people do it.
Like, you nearly approached that with the fact that they were both yuppies and they were both like arriving in to sort of take over, but then any semblance of that just goes when
once you go straight to the trope.
Exactly.
Yeah. First, sort of that you have to have a horror movie, sort of like slashers.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, and even beyond that, and you know that's bad enough, but I mean the clunky plot points, like it's really grimly effective initially. Like, you think, okay, this could get savage in a way that kind of, you know, could really work, you know, but it kind of abandons that to like really clunking cliches that you're kind of, what? Yeah. Literally nobody would do that. And you know, that's the kind of thing of shouting at kind of horror films that do stupid things.
Don't go in there.
Yeah, yeah. There's so much of that.
Why would you run up the stairs?
But I just
don't
like,
demonize the working class.
Once you're running up the stairs. But it's kind of horrible.
I've always been slightly baffled by the kind of critical reputation it's maintained, because even still people kind of hold it up as one of the great horrors of the last decade or so.
I went on to Letterboxd and see my friends what they thought of it, and you click through it, and there's quite a
and
few
Jay
more.
Was Jay was judging all of you.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. But some people were kind of down on it, and that's fair enough, but there was quite a few four and a half, five star reviews.
I've never been able to understand it.
Again, though, I think the large part of that's down to what we saw with and we talked about this in the podcast before, Hereditary early this year, where it's a certain type of horror film that tickles a certain type of nostalgia. In this case, 70s nostalgia, in the same way. And we talked about New Hollywood earlier in the podcast, but that's the one that sort of tickles the fancy of a certain kind of film watcher.
Yeah.
And I suspect that was at a play with Hereditary. That's why the people liked it, because it's the thing that they like. And I suspect that's the stuff here. It's like, people watching this, I don't think, clocked that it was a work, you know, demonizing the working class.
Yeah, there's nobody watching it and thinking, "Oh, demonizing the working class, just what I wanted."
Yeah. No, I mean,
if only I hadn't watched that Ken Loach film earlier, I could just accept all my sympathy.
Accept this with as it is. But are looking at it and seeing it as a well-made throwback to a kind of horror film that, you know, is produced, mass-produced, but not with this level.
I agree. I think there's even nostalgia in it, like in the sense of, you know, why can't they just make savage films about killing working class people anymore? It's the political correctness gone mad.
But it's a tendency of people not to dig into the sort of underlying implications of, I think, horror cinema
horror,
in particular. Yeah. People very rarely engage.
Horror film is so rich for that, which is absurd that people don't.
That is, and I don't want to derail the podcast too much on this, but I would argue that one of the reasons why horror works as well as it does for people is because you don't dig into it. It pushes that button primarily.
I think good horror does this subtly.
Someone's chasing it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think this does this particularly subtly, and I'm entirely agreeing with Jay. I'm not at all saying this is a misunderstood masterpiece with a more nuanced take on class structure in Great Britain. I think it's more that this appeals, you know, sort of in terms of
I completely agree. And if you watch it with any kind of blinkers on in that regard, I imagine you get a lot more out of it than I would. But how anybody could watch it without noticing that is beyond me. Yeah. But that's maybe if we're talking about how we watch films in that regard, which is a different thing altogether.
Yeah.
Well, maybe a different thing altogether, but anyway, I still have a grudge. And finally, just before I finish up, sorry I mentioned, I rewatched Inglourious Basterds because I kind of found it on TV in Denmark, and I was like, well,
why not?
Why not? And, you know, we got to bed on holidays. It's perhaps, and it's going to sound controversial, maybe, my favourite Tarantino after Jackie Brown.
Last good Tarantino.
Yeah, maybe. It's pretty great. There's issues with it. I don't think it's perfect, but there's so much great stuff in it. Mm. And I was chatting around Pitt's kind of speech to the French or to his
the Nazi ain't got no humanity.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I just want to kill Nazis. That's it. There's no other answer other than that.
This is a movie where the only good German is the one who shoves his fist down the throat of a Nazi commandant lying on the bed.
Yeah.
It's a movie which is
not subtle.
It's not subtle, and it's almost endearing. And I think that one of the interesting aspects of Django is how Tarantino responds to the privilege of being able to say the only good German is the one who smothers Nazi commandants in their sleep by having Christoph Waltz as a white savior screw everything up horribly by acting with that sort of moral absolutism. But I do think that, yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating film.
Very fascinating. Like, it's generally, it's kind of set around two or three great set pieces that work tremendously well.
Yeah. Particularly the opening sequence, which is
the opening sequence is a great one. Like, it's one of the all-time greats.
Genuinely. It's Tarantino's best work, probably, in terms of individual scenes.
How it's shot, how the camera moves, how it's acted,
the undertones.
It's got an exceptional sense of pace in that and other scenes.
And it's really able to, how the language works, sort of switching from English to French to German. And it's really, really, really kind of full of depth. Like, and you kind of miss that Tarantino a little bit. And
about half an hour later, you miss that Tarantino.
I think I agree with you. Like, it's Jackie Brown and then it's Inglourious.
I think it is. For me, anyway, I would have to revisit two films.
Like, I feel like we've already buried them and erected a monument, apparently.
The thing about Tarantino
is, somebody who loved Django and somebody
who loved Hateful
Eight.
Right? Okay. I've major issues, particularly the last two Tarantino films and with various others, like Death Proof, which is one of the worst things I've ever seen. But,
insufferable.
And this is the funny thing, I will pretty much always go see a new Tarantino film because, despite the frustrations, there's always something fascinating and interesting going on. Like, and you can't say that about every filmmaker. Like, you can't, like, even if I bang my head off a wall, the next thing could be amazing. And then it could be a 15-minute sustained sequence of brilliance.
When he's good, he's, like, the best. And that's why it's so frustrating to watch something like Death Proof.
And I know, Darren, you're a huge fan, so I don't want to kick him to around the place.
No, I think we're all fans. That's why we're criticizing.
Darren is late Tarantino fan. He's a big late... He's a late Tarantino fan, like more than we would be. Okay.
Probably, yes.
Hateful Eight was your
Hateful
best
Eight
film.
Hateful Eight was my favorite film of 2016.
Yeah, which was probably somewhere down beside Dennis Menace 4 for me, or whatever animated film that I saw that year. But
I like that Jay is not... This is Jay not kicking me.
No, I'm not. No, I'm saying... That,
anyway,
no. I'm not kicking you.
I know.
If I kicked you, you'd know about it. But anyway, that's me.
So, Alex.
So, I saw three films since the last time I did one of these. The first one was Game Night, which I'd heard a lot about, and I enjoyed. I mean, as someone who's a huge fan of David Fincher, it really appealed to me to see a David Fincher parody film with nods to Fight Club and The Game and all these things. But also that it worked without being too like, oh, I see what they're doing now with this tracking shot. And my girlfriend who watched it with me also enjoyed it because of the cast. It's very fun. It doesn't take itself too seriously. It speeds along, which is always good for one of these. Like,
I agree.
It's about 100 minutes long.
Bits of it, like,
absolutely.
It just
doesn't spend too long. No. There's a lot of good performances. Jesse Plemons is really funny.
She's phenomenal.
So yeah, I had a good time watching Game Night.
I enjoyed it. I have to say, it was kind of one of those, even though people had been kind of praising it fairly as a kind of real film, like, I was kind of like, he's still pleasantly surprised that how much it kind of, like, because usually I'm able to go, ah, for God. And then, no, it didn't. It's actually good.
Yeah. It's solid. Yeah. It's not fantastic, but it's solid. Yeah, it's good. The other one that I watched was Like Father, which is a Netflix release starring
with Kelsey Grammer and Kristen Bell.
And again, one that I kind of just based on the cast. I was like, yeah, I'll watch this. It's got two actors who
keep up with Netflix releases. There's like 100 films.
It's going to get
better. There's been another 50 since we started the podcast.
Yeah, I suspect you may make room in your schedule later this year, though.
There's a good few coming. But this one was interesting because it was sort of one that I, based on the cast alone, assumed would be a comedy. It's directed by Judith Miller-Rogan, and Seth Rogen is also in it. I was sort of like, okay, this should be fun. And it's actually much more of a drama. You know, it's shot and handheld. It's about a woman who is a workaholic, and she kind of screws up her wedding day because she can't really get off the phone to work. And her husband gets cold feet and runs away. And she gets hammered then with her estranged dad, and they wake up on her honeymoon cruise. And that's the, like, elevator pitch. So they're both
in the same room.
Concept. Frasier is her dad.
I was going to say, if you skewed this slightly, you'd have an Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah, it's a very simple...
Thankfully we don't.
But then what's strange is that it sort of opens as being like, okay, this is all set up, and it never really is funny. Now, that's not to say it's bad. It's that they both all give very good performances, but it just skews a lot more towards drama than...
Deliberately or just...
Very much deliberately. Yeah, okay. And it's shot, like, as I sort of said, handheld rather than the sort of usual comedy sort of cuts and stuff. We get a lot of long, lingering takes of Kelsey Grammer's crumpled face and Christian...
He does have a good crumpled face, though.
He does crumpled face. And then Seth Rogen has a sort of funny enough cameo more than an actual role as a sort of love interest. But it's really just about these two characters and how very, very similar they are, and how she's sort of almost annoyed about the fact that she's inherited all her father's like worst traits, and that drives her mad. So it's very good. It's just I went in expecting a comedy, and was sort of like, oh right, no, this is a.
I kind of bumped that on my list now because it sounds kind of interesting enough.
The other key thing is it's not too long. It's
this is always a wonder, isn't it?
Just the immediate seal of approval.
And then the final film I watched, which I'm almost ashamed to say because I've never seen it before, was Spirited Away.
Oh,
I know. For years, I just couldn't get into Studio Ghibli, and I think it's because I watched some of the lesser known ones and was like, I just can't get in. Yeah. And then whenever anyone would recommend this one, I'd be like, you know.
Maybe someday.
And that day was Sunday, and I was blown away, and it was incredible, and given me a new, you know, appreciation for the genre and that particular studio.
It is pretty
and everything.
Incredible, right?
It is.
So, yeah, everything people have said about this is absolutely true. It's incredible, yeah.
Spirited Away really is magnificent. I think it was one of the later ones I watched, and it's kind of above and beyond. I think it's my favorite at this point.
It is the highest ranked one on the Internet Movie Database. It's top 250.
Deservedly so. That's
the highest animated film as well.
Wow. It's I put it right up there with Totoro and
Grave of the
Grave
Fireflies. Which
and
is overrated.
Princess Mononoke. No, it's not.
What?
Stop it. Darren is just being a
Grave
Darren.
Of the Fireflies overrated.
Totoro is the much better part of that double bill. A double feature.
What a double bill.
I don't
it is
think
a great
so.
Double bill.
No.
Just
no,
refusing to accept
that. I Grave of the Fireflies is incredible.
I haven't... an emotional attachment I can't disconnect to that film because I watched it at a relatively young age with my younger sister.
Were in Packers the Bodhi, like.
But that's kind of what I felt about Spirited Away, that it was amazing to sort of be so wrapped up in an animation film to the point where I remember thinking, this is how I felt watching The Lion King in the cinema in 94, you know what I mean?
But it felt seismic. I completely agree. I just thought when it came out.
So it was kind of heartening in a sense to have that in my late 20s, but also then also, you know, very much appreciate this film. It's incredible.
So wait in your late 30s when it becomes even more elusive,
so
Alex.
Save those Ghibli films.
I will. I'll just slowly wean myself onto them.
I'm forward to sobbing.
Save one until the retirement home.
I love the idea of watching Totoro at the age of 80, feeling that child.
I get it. And then dying.
Time.
Yeah. So that's the other two films I saw, I think, are in the top 10, so we can talk about them later.
Ronan.
I haven't been here for 2 weeks, but I still have managed to see almost nothing because...
I know you've seen something.
Oh, I've seen something. But before we dive down that deep, dark well, let's look at Orson Welles at the IFI. Went along to the season they have there to accompany the Eyes of Orson Welles and Our Cousin documentary. So I caught Citizen Kane for what I only realized was my second time and first in 8 years since literally day one of film school years and years ago. And it's really interesting to watch this film that was used once upon a time to teach me the basics of construction of shots and editing and the rest, to now watch it from a perspective where I know considerably more about that. I've seen many, many thousands more films. And it does stand up very well. There's a reason people put it up there. It's got all these modern parallels that people like talking about because Donald Trump is very fond of calling it his favorite film.
His favorite film without any sense of irony.
Really?
Do you not see that interview he did for the documentary on it?
No.
The documentary was never released, but he did this sort of talking head thing where he talked about it as his favorite film in a way that suggested he may have somehow missed what many people would consider to be the entire point of the film.
I think I read Atlas Shrugged when I was about 9 and thought it was about trains and like didn't get it at all for years. And then
you and Donald Trump,
9-year-old me and Donald Trump,
you were considerably
so it's basically
smarter.
A wish fulfillment fantasy is what we're going for here.
There's this strange moment where he's going on about if he's elected to high office, he will imprison his opponent. And I'm sitting in the cinema thinking, oh, good lord. This film is over 75 years old.
I think the fascinating thing about Citizen Kane is that it's so familiar to everyone. Like, even people that don't watch films really know it. Even if it's just from Simpsons references. Kane from Citizen Kane. But, like, it's so familiar. And it's easy to be cynical and dismissive about it. And I see it. Even the other day, I saw somebody being kind of like, couldn't believe how people would consider it the best Wells. And it's like, Jesus, how much film... do you need to be that dismissive? Because, like, regardless of whether you think it's the greatest film ever, all time, or whatever, that these things are, and arbitrary lists and canon and all that kind of stuff. But like it practically invented huge amounts of film language.
That's exactly the thing. It brings up really interesting questions of people say, "Oh, I don't see what the big fuss is." Yeah, because you're 77 years divorced from the context in which the film was released,
and the films you do love are probably directly descended from.
I mean, the depth of field on the stage was unprecedented at the time,
but it still is. It's still incredible.
Yeah, it still looks distinctive. It does look weird.
Seen it on a big screen in IFI 1.
Yes, I've seen it on a big screen. It's incredible.
It's astonishing. Yeah. It really is. It kind of bathes you in this, you know, the shots where the young Wells is way in the back of the frame while his parents argue over his future.
Yeah,
in the front.
Yeah, yeah.
And Wells was fascinated.
But that's through the window, isn't it?
Wells was fascinated with many different art forms, but he intrinsically understood cinema in this, his first film.
It's incredible. It's disgusting.
Realizing what at the time a lot of people weren't doing with the medium to tell stories. And I think it's
right up there because it should be right up there. Mm-hmm. And it should be right up there for its own, for form, for whatever you want to say.
But
that,
I mean, even in terms of narrative. I mean, like, even in terms of, like, divorcing the whole film technique from it and the fact that it holds up as well as it does. Like, I would argue, even if you have grown up with that 77-year gap in whatever, watching it, it's still a fantastic accomplishment. Like, it's still... Yeah. Like, it's still a fantastic...
Because it plays like one of these film noir detective stories as well, that it's just this mystery of who was this? What was this thing? What's Rosebud? Yeah. So it really drags you in that way.
Yeah. I think I was like 18 when I saw Force as well, so I wasn't. I didn't catch it as young. I was kind of one of those things that I kind of eventually watched on TV one day. Yeah. And when you're 18, you're kind of determined not to like something in a way, you know, kind of,
traditional old stuff.
Just my dad loves this. But I mean, we're stunned by it then on a TV, on a crappy little TV. Yeah. It's essential.
Yeah.
Move from that the next day to Magnificent Ambersons, which I hadn't seen before. And has quite a towering reputation these days, actually. A lot of Wells purists sort of pointed out as, oh, it's an improvement upon, it's better than.
I don't
feel that way, and I think it's interesting because there's a sort of fractured history there. Yeah. There's lots of stuff missing. We don't really know what Wells intended. I'm sure it's something we'll be discussing later. It's got chunks of it missing, and it's hard to tell if it's close to his vision for it.
It's fascinating.
It
and
works
really,
really well,
really
I
good,
think, in the form we have now. Yeah, it's terrific, and there's more of that stagecraft and that depth of field and everything. He's shifted DP here. It's not Greg Tolland anymore. I can't remember who the name of the replacement was. But it's not anywhere near as sort of towering an achievement for me.
I think people,
and maybe if I come back,
I think people get to the point of what could have been, which it's the reputation of what could have been that towers over Kane, I think.
And I'm sure we won't be having this conversation in about 2.5 months.
Mm-hmm. Oh, indeed, yeah.
No more Orson Welles films to come. He's long dead.
How could we get
that? Just click on the internet and have a little sip of my coffee.
it was really good to catch that and finally get a chance to see it. And it's one of those ones that I've had the chance to see in the past, but I said I'd sort of hold out for this kind of
project.
It was great to see it that way.
Yes.
Projected on 35 as well. As part of that season, then, of course, they had The Eyes of Orson Welles, the Cousins documentary, and he came to the IFI to introduce it, gave this wonderful introduction where he's a really amazing presence. I mean, he was on his way to Manchester for a screening and posted on Twitter that he was eating chocolate penises with a hen party.
I saw that.
He's a fantastically fun person, you know, while he's doing these documentaries, digging deep into sort of artistry and aesthetics. I really, really liked it. I think Cousins is very love him, hate him for a lot of people. There are a lot of people that can't stand that voice.
Kind of find him really soothing. And really,
There's something lyrical about it. Rhythmic.
Well, he
works with the rhythm of his
editing.
About
how he's been asked to read various inappropriate statements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did see that,
And it's extremely indulgent, and he fully indulges it here. So if you haven't liked him in the past, you are not going to change your mind here.
But on the other hand...
I really went with it, and it's got a very unique, interesting approach to Wells. He made the point at the Q&A afterwards. He said it's obviously excluding the 14-hour essential TV series that he's made before. He said it's the longest film he's made, but he felt that nobody else is going to make a film about Orson Welles from the perspective of his paintings and drawings.
Yeah.
So it made sense for him to accept whatever length felt right. Yeah. And it's really interesting route into him. Cousins is a great scholar, so he delves with great detail into often a lot of Welles' less well-remembered films. He deals for a while with The Immortal Story, which I talked about on the podcast a couple of months back, He spends a lot of time with, I can't remember the name of the film, Mr. Arcaden, I think, that I hadn't even heard of before. He's really good at delving into the sort of treasure trove.
He finds stuff, like, he makes
FBI.
You think about.
He does, he really does. And he takes some strange steps here that sort of raise my eyebrows a little, but won me over eventually. It's really well worth seeing. I think it's one of those interesting sort of biographical approaches that constantly acknowledges its own restrictions and that it is, you know, delving into his personal prejudices as a fan.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting critical study.
Very good.
I suppose as we're on the theme of canon, I rewatched Mean Girls, which I think we can all admit is great.
Up there with Citizen Kane, I think. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I only saw it the first time a couple of years ago.
To be fair, it is one of the great films of the, was it 2001? So would it be the 20th century?
2004.
So it is one of the great defining films for an entire generation of
fans. It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just gets overshadowed by the canon and inverted commas that exists of Fight Club.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I will take this over Fight Club.
Oh, me too. I think everyone would.
Absolutely every day of the week.
It's great.
Yeah, it's terrific fun. Great to read it. I don't know how many times I've seen it now, but not enough. And shall we talk about a newer release?
Let's talk about a newer release. It was released last week. It didn't make the top 10.
It didn't make the top 10, which is such a terrible shame because the world deserves this. The world actually does deserve this. Right?
I wasn't here for this, and pretty much everyone, as far as I could see, went to see it. So I'm going to get my popcorn now and enjoy it.
This is a film that has received relatively decent reviews.
Which is surprising.
Yeah,
given a sort of highly problematic
film that has its issues narratively but is saved by a towering performance. It has a towering performance, but it's Emma Thompson doing Judge Judy.
Just in case we kept our listeners on tender hooks for too long there.
Yeah, the Children Act. Emma Thompson doing Judge Judy sounds like the greatest elevator pitch of all time, but it's only that for 5 minutes in one like hastily edited scene that works really well, because it's like the pitch of that scene is Emma Thompson has had a bad day and is taking no shit.
It's a montage.
And it breezes through, and it was the one moment of the film where I was glad to be sitting in that cinema. She gives a great performance because she always does, but the film that it supports, that it doesn't support, because nothing could, is nonsense. Absolute nonsense. I've not read the novel it's based on. I'm a big McEwan fan, but it's tripe and doesn't make any sense. And nothing the film does makes any sense of it. It doesn't help that it's terribly, terribly, terribly directed. Richard Eyre, I think, is the director.
Yep. The man responsible for Notes on a Scandal and Iris.
Yeah,
he's
got some major films under his belt, but has been working in TV for 10 years and not looked at my nose TV in any way, but it shows.
It has a very BBC prime time sort of...
Worth noting that he worked with McEwan on a TV movie in, I think, the 80s called The Ploughman's Lunch, starring Jonathan Pryce, which is really good.
Yeah, that is good.
It's really good. I haven't seen it
in a long time, but yeah.
McEwan, it's not based on any of McEwan's works, but McEwan wrote the script in his sort of, I think he's written three scripts that weren't based on existing material. And it's a really interesting film. This has absolutely none of that. I've talked to people who've read the novel.
And there's problems with the novel as well.
These problems are coming from the novel, but there's absolutely nothing whatsoever in the film that makes any attempt to address them. If anything, it highlights them. I think Eyre's direction is just nonsense as well. He keeps going into courtrooms and thinking, what would really spice this shot up? Let's shoot it from the corner of the room. And you're just sort of looking, what are you doing? You're not adding anything here. You're just giving me an extra 10 seconds I have to sit here looking at people walking down corridors. The dramatics of it are completely off from... I think the first scene is Stanley Tucci and Emma Thompson. Stanley Tucci plays Emma Thompson's husband here. He comes home and is really annoyed that she won't join him for a night at the theatre, and she says something to the effect of, I'm busy working tonight, and he, like, you know, angrily under his breath says, like, every night. There's just no nuance there whatsoever.
This all builds to the sequence in the trailer in which he explains that he's not having an affair, but he's going to have an affair. So we're going to have a conversation about that, because this is the kind of thing that happens in a drama like this, I guess.
It's really convinced of its own adultness.
Yeah.
In that it sets up this sort of dual moral dilemma where this is the problem she has at home, where her husband says that their marriage isn't working for them anymore. He doesn't want it to end, but he wants to have an affair because he's not sexually satisfied. And he's letting her know. He's going to do it whatever she thinks, yeah. But he's letting her know. And in her professional life, she is forced to make a very difficult decision about a Jehovah's Witness child who is in need of a blood transfusion, which is not permitted by that religion. And what will she do in both situations? And the idea of a structure like this is to play them off each other and to make revelations about...
One in the other.
Yeah. What in this case tells me what I can do in my personal life. Yeah. And for me, as well as neither of them being in any way dramatically engaging, because they're so overplayed, and she literally plays guitar and sings a song with the extremely pale dying boy.
Who, for some reason, keeps calling her my lady. In this like weird like BDSM thing. It's very uncomfortable.
It's very odd. But the way they inform each other largely amounts, in the end, to the film saying, and I'm very conscious that it's written by a man who's looking at this woman, that it's really unreasonable of her not to let her husband cheat on her. That's sort of the conclusion of the film. And we haven't even got to the point where there's people keep arriving in rooms soaked and being told, you're drenched.
It possibly has my favourite mad times. Russian romantic comedy to the departure land sequence. It's just so brilliantly tone deaf. Ronan's gas. So Ronan knows the scene I'm talking about. If you've seen the movie, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's amazing. It's like something from Love Actually, except the film is not pitching itself as Love Actually.
Completely straight-faced.
Yeah.
This is strange, because as I said last week, I read the book a few years ago, and... largely remembered it being told kind of from her perspective, and therefore a lot of the more ridiculous elements are therefore softened because they're kind of...
From a perspective point of view.
There's still issues with the book. It's not necessarily a great book by any means, but I think from hearing you guys talk about it, it sounds like they've portrayed a lot of the implied...
relatively straight.
Yeah. I can imagine it working on the page because this is very much a drama of interiority.
Yeah.
And the way that this impacts on somebody and the way they think. McEwan, as a screenwriter and Eyre as a director, do not know how to portray that in any way. And they get to a point, and this is actually one of my favorite reviews ever written by Roger Ebert about John Huston's The Dead, where he talks about how James Joyce's story does this wonderful thing at the end of it where it brings everything together that's come before, and it expresses by going into the characters' heads exactly what's been going on in the story the whole time you've been reading it. And the film adaptation is hampered by the fact that you can't do that in cinema. And Ebert's piece is brilliant. The Children Act literally robs that last scene of the dead. There are lines lifted from it. Wow. I don't know if this is in the novel, but there is a moment where I sort of I was ready to stand up. This is the dead. They're looking out over snow. They're absolutely doing the dead.
I don't remember that from the end of the book. Now I might have got around.
I wonder if it's an invention. They absolutely do the dead, like down to the point where the character breaks down at a certain line.
Oh, for the dead.
I love the idea of McEwan typing into Google, how do I convey interiority on film, and landing on the Ebert review and being like, that's how I do it.
But the thing about the point Ebert made about the dead is that John Huston knows that you can't do that in cinema, and he loves the story so much that he does what he can anyway.
It does well.
He does exactly as well as you can. The Children Act has nothing to build on to do that, and it's stealing. So that was the point. That was the point where I just thought, "I'm actually terrible."
I'm getting a feeling you don't like this one.
That's
the greatest comedy of the year.
Take that, Game Night.
And there have been a lot of reviews that say, "Oh, Emma Thompson nearly saves it. She's very good.
She is very good."
But oh God, no.
Okay. Well, there's the person on the steering wheel in the Titanic. Yeah. I'm sure he was doing a good job too.
Indeed.
All right, so I had a relatively quiet week. I rewatched A Quiet Place, which I know Jay and Ronan didn't like, but I found remarkable because I watched it with the extended family. And I had the same experience that I had watching it in cinema, which is everybody was really, really quiet while watching it.
Which is good.
It's great. First of all, it's great in terms of cinematica, but it's also really great just at a visceral level in terms of like that sort of engagement with the story and what cinema can do in that sort of respect. I don't think it's particularly nuanced or deep, but I think it's very effectively made for what it's doing. I also watched for the first time Phase 4, Saul Bass's only film. I can't believe I hadn't seen this before.
I still haven't seen it.
It's fantastic, isn't it? Yeah. It's got this sort of pulpy B-movie vibe, so if you're not a fan of like stilted heightened performances or budget constraints, maybe be a bit wary.
Extreme close-ups of ants.
Yeah. That's the thing. It has these wonderful inserts of like ants marching. It has one of the most moving scenes in cinema that I have seen this year, which is the ant funeral, where there's a little sort of a room full of ants who have died in service of this agenda, who've been arranged by their fellow ants into little rows of dead bodies while sad music plays. It's astonishingly beautiful.
It's really on Netflix.
People say there are never any old movies on Netflix. I went on Netflix and tried to find the oldest movie that I could find, and I found Phase 4. Hadn't seen it before, had heard lots of things about it, had never made time for it. I was just like, there's no way I'm not watching this. It's great fun. It's got that sort of 70s throwback vibe. Yeah. It's got that sort of like, which is great because it's weird watching nostalgia from a different era. Like, you know the way now at the moment we're very invested in 90s nostalgia, 2000s nostalgia, whether you want to accept Lady Bird as an example of that or not. But like, this is 70s doing 50s nostalgia. Yeah. So it's like them or all these other sort of creature features, but done in the style of like a 70s sort of new Hollywood sort of paranoid sort of fever dream. It has this sort of narration from characters, mad scientists, the scientist who's too obsessed with systems to worry about people. Yeah. You have this sort of this wonderful metaphor that plays through the ants in terms of communists, where they're like 50s invasion of the body snatchers. Yeah, Ronan talked about it a little while ago, where it's like, can you imagine a society where everybody's entirely equal and they all act as one part of the whole? What sort of monstrous thing is this? It's beautiful. I would wholeheartedly recommend it if you haven't seen it, if you like being as a creature.
It's got this amazing melancholy tone of we are all absolutely doomed and we probably deserve it.
Yeah. And I mean like, again,
right up my street.
Yes.
The only observation I would make in terms of if you will judge whether or not you like this film or not by the ant funeral scene. If the premise of a sequence of ants burying one another,
sounds amazing.
Yeah, I gotta say, like,
it's incredibly done. How vast it is, I don't know.
Again, this day you would do it with CGI and it would be horrible, but these are actually really close-ups of ants doing things. You have sequences of like ants attacking in sequence or ants hitting a praying mantis. It's wonderfully well put together.
I would imagine they just filmed ants for days and then edited what they could to make it look wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Movie Magic.
Sorry, you don't ruin the magic. Sorry.
At the sort of moment of epiphany. I also then finally watched Beware the Slender Man, which aired after, in a wonderful feat of programming, Sky Atlantic screened this directly following the last episode of Sharp Objects, which is just perfect programming. Whoever scheduled that deserves some sort of like Emmy for scheduling.
It's this horror film, is it?
No, so Slender Man is the movie that's in cinemas at the moment, which is apparently awful, and I may be talking about it on some other podcast at some point in the near future. Beware the Slender Man is a documentary that was made in 2015,
that murder case.
It is about and everything else. It's part of the problem with it is that it's too broad. It tries to do absolutely everything. It's like, oh, would you like an oral history of the Slender Man? Ooh, would you like this oral history of the case? Would you like to talk about children on the internet? Maybe. Would you like to talk about memes? Would you like to talk about the internet?
No, not really focusing on anything.
It's got so much going on.
Everything badly. Yeah.
No, well, to be fair, I actually quite enjoyed it. But it does. It feels like it could use a much tighter focus. There's a whole host of stuff in there that's more interesting than the true crime stuff, but there's a sense the true crime stuff is there because like people like true crime documentaries. Whereas the stuff where you're talking about like the viral transmission of memes or the idea that like the Slender Man is an idea that's rooted in like consciousness that you can trace back to stuff like the Pied Piper of Hamelin. It's just expressing itself in a digital age. That sort of stuff's fascinating. The idea of... And it's great because the movie... And in part because it does so much, because it sort of spreads its attention so wide. What would become like a moral panic internet story about kids, because it touches on that thing that we were talking about with Luke, where you have children unattended watching YouTube videos and the crazy stuff that they watch that's produced by algorithms. But it's also talking about how as worrying as that might be for parents, it takes a huge confluence of circumstances for something like the infamous Slender Man stabbing case to happen. It isn't just that the kids knew about Slender Man. It isn't just that one of them had undiagnosed schizophrenia. It isn't just that one of their parents was going through a divorce. It was also the fact that they were socially isolated at the same time, and all these factors came into play together to create this sort of horrific set of circumstances, which is a very interesting you know, sort of relatively nuanced look at it for a documentary looking at a single topic, but it does feel like it casts its net just a little bit too wide.
Documentaries, I get a bit kind of cranky about documentaries a lot about certain things, how they portray these things or get too broad or get too ambitious, that sometimes a simple story well told is kind of forgotten a lot of the time. Like, just do the thing as opposed to trying to bring too much commentary or whatever into it.
There is an argument to be said in terms of like this being a movie about like an internet phenomenon, it having this sort of apophenia approach to things where it's like everything matters because it's like looking at the internet where there's just so much information there trying to make that. Now, I don't think it works, but I think it's interesting.
Okay.
I think a lot of the individual elements and threads are fascinating of themselves. I just don't think that all of them are necessary and that they cohere into something perfect.
And no doubt to trim any of those would possibly invite accusations of being blinkered.
Yeah.
That would be it, exactly.
No, fair enough.
If you focus on the internet, you very much end up with a moral panic story. If you focus on the schizophrenia aspect and the raising the kids, you'd focus on like a sort of exploitative sort of grimy story.
Fair enough, that's fair.
That sort of stuff. But anyway, let's move on to talk about the week in film news. The Farthest won the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine Award, won the Film, TV and Radio Award at their award ceremony on Sunday. So it's quite impressive.
Fantastic. That film has done really, really well.
Yeah, it is. It's a fantastic film. I think everybody here has seen it.
I think I saw it like four times. Each time I had to like bring someone else and be like, no, it's so good, we have to go. And like,
it's pretty great.
I never got to.
I really, really liked it.
I would wholeheartedly recommend it.
I think it's the last film we saw in Savoy 1 as well.
Oh. Which makes it sort of sad of the movie. Mine was The Last Jedi. But we won't talk about that.
I think I got to get a better deal here.
I saw it at the same screen as you, actually. Okay, cool. Also, I'm going to move from talking about The Farthest to talking about the Varda Fest, which is happening at the IFI in September. Jay hinted at this a couple of weeks ago. You were very excited about the prospect of the IFI running a season.
I think they essentially winked at that. They were going to do it. God bless them.
They've
six films coming up.
Not including the new one.
No, not including Face to Place, which is also fantastic. And I think it's only top 10 of the year. I'll miss the first one, unfortunately, but I'll be at the other five.
Yeah, I've got my tickets already for all six. I cannot wait. I think I haven't seen a single one of the ones they're showing.
I cannot wait to watch the one I've seen, which is Vagabond.
It's actually on movie at the moment, but I'm going to hold out for the big screen.
So just to run very quickly and to mangle the pronunciation,
do it.
Le Pont Court is airing on Saturday the 8th of September at 2 p.m.
That's the one I'll miss.
Yeah, the following day at 3:30 p.m. you have Cleo from 9 to 5. On Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. you have Le Bonheur. One Sings, the Other Doesn't is airing on Saturday the 15th of September at 1:15. Vagabond is airing the following day in the 3:30 slot. And then the final film of the festival of the season is The Gleaners and I, which is airing on Wednesday the 19th.
Which I've heard amazingly
good. That's one of the late Verda documentaries that has got this
incredible reputation. It was 2000 or so, from years ago.
I can't wait for this. This is the highlight of September.
Fair play to the IFI.
They do some fantastic
work. And Faceless Places will be screening plenty. Go see it.
Faceless Places is fantastic.
All right, and then Screen Ireland has announced two new appointments. Emer Markey has been appointed as the development executive, while Grace Cannon will join the agency as the business affairs coordinator.
So I didn't get the job, is that what you're telling me?
Despite your application.
This is how you find out.
This
seems cruel. Somebody could have shed me a leg.
Run for the presidency.
You're like that guy from Lethal Weapon who found out he was fired over social media, apparently.
The TV series?
The infamous sort of Lions, playing sort of the Mel Gibson role. Who would have thought that role would attract a certain kind of vocal actor? And then the big one is the BFI London Film Festival has announced its schedule running from the 10th to the 21st of October.
I was looking at this morning and thinking, what prices are flights?
I might go over.
And the accommodation, and then it's like, no, I couldn't do it. But Jesus, the lineup is pretty goddamn
really
good.
Great.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, they've got gender parity in three of the four competition strands.
Yeah, 38% overall, I think, but 60 in one of the categories.
Yeah,
I think,
which is
first features maybe
on the way.
Quite astounding, given obviously the situation.
Over to you, Venice.
Venice
today
and
signed the pledge for gender parity.
Good.
I'm not sure what the long term.
Guillermo del Toro kind of took the class as well.
They need a bloody commitment.
But yeah, so the BFI London Film Festival looks fantastic. There's Irish films over there as well, so there's Dublin Old School, The Favourite, Poppy Chulo and Rosie as well.
And Lenny Abramson on the jury.
He's heading the jury, isn't he?
He also has. And they also have Madeline's Madeline, which Galway had before it.
Which you've been raving about.
Which is
Yeah, it took me like 2 days to process it.
Mm.
I wasn't even sure I liked it after I watched it. And
I think we recorded the day after.
Yeah, and I couldn't get my head around it, but
still processing.
It's great. I can't wait to see it again, actually.
All right.
So, there you go.
So move on to the top 10. At number 10, Mission Impossible Fallout, which will soon be falling out, unfortunately.
Very good. It had a good run.
It did.
As does Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Indeed. Thank you, Brad. I quite appreciate that. 2 million to date at the Irish box office. At number 9, Ant-Man and the Wasp.
I only saw this last week, and yeah, it's fine.
Yeah,
I think
it's good. It's
the thing that bothers me most is that like the parts where it almost approaches being a comedy and doesn't quite get
commit
there.
To it. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like, I think Randall Park is very funny in it. He plays the FBI handler guy.
Sort of,
and he's a great bit where he finds out Ant-Man is doing something and goes, "What the Dickens?" And I remember laughing at that and thinking, "I'd like more of that." You know, almost originally, I remember hearing when they were casting Ant-Man and it was Edgar Wright and Paul Rudd and thinking like, all right, are we getting some sort of like kooky actual comedy version? Yeah. And it first one never really got there. It had the odd moment. And then the second one just kind of does the similar kind of, we're not quite a comedy, but we have funny people.
We're a
in
little
it.
Lighter, but we're not too light. Well, I mean, this is my big issue with the whole Marvel blockbuster thing, is that there's no real tonal variance.
Yeah.
And this is because you have this idea that when you're doing stuff like you're doing The Winter Soldier or you're doing stuff like Iron Man 3, what you're doing is you're shifting genres. But there's always this emphasis on maintaining consistency, which means that you can't really do a 70s political thriller with Captain America because it has to remain in the confines of like the cinematic style of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, we've discussed this. I really can't see why you can't, quite frankly. I mean,
you can't because Kevin Feige says you can't.
Yeah, but no, but that's exactly the reason. Like, I would have been happy to see a knockabout comedy then. Pick your horror director, do a different one, pick your whatever. Like, it doesn't really matter. As long as the story stays relative to the
it shouldn't really matter.
And it
made
the dollars anyway. So.
Yeah, I think that's where this new Ant-Man falls down, because there's a funny cast in there. They're just not really been given that much.
It is the most overqualified cast in an MCU film that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
That is saying something.
Yeah.
Michelle Pfeiffer, Lawrence Fishburne shows up at the end to raise her eyebrow. And
Randall Park, as you mentioned.
I will see it because I kind of really, really like that man. To my surprise, I enjoyed it a lot, probably a lot more than most did. So I'll get there.
I liked it a little bit.
I liked
it. Didn't grow on me.
I was going to say I liked it because it's like a smaller story and it works.
I hate you all.
No, but I think that Ant-Man and the Wasp has a sting in the tail.
Oh, good lord.
Okay, at number 8, it's The Spy Who Dumped Me, starring Mila Kunis and Kate McKinnon.
What's the word of this? Like, I really like the trailer, but I suspect it's one of those all the jokes in the trailer type things.
There are two words on this. The first word is that it is surprisingly violent for a comedy film, particularly for a film spoofing the spy genre. Apparently, it gets quite graphic at points. The second one on it is that apparently it has a really good first hour, which always I was going to say, it always sort of sets my it's about 2 hours long, but it sort of sets my
90 minutes, please.
Yeah. My eyebrows sort of arch when I hear it has a good first hour. I'm like, well,
how many hours is
it? I'm not just going to get up and walk out when my watch reaches 60 minutes. At number 7, it's Incredibles 2, which has so far earned $4.1 million at the Irish box office.
There may come a point where Pixar movies will become essential to seeing the cinema again. We have not yet reached that point.
Whoa. Hold on now. Sorry. To be fair, first of all, you liked Coco, right? I didn't like Coco, but I did like it.
I know what you mean. People aren't rushing to them in the same way that they rushed Inside Out.
Inside Out was only 3 years ago.
Again,
I feel like this is the Tarantino thing. It's like we're burying him, and he's like, dude, I'm still breathing.
There's a thing with Pixar. There's a perception, fair or otherwise, and I think to some degree it's fair, that they're churning out
sequels.
I saw Toy Story 4 is doing that summer. See, that's actually happening. No one stopped that.
No one has put their foot down.
See, Dan, I think that's the thing. It cheapens the brand. And when the brand gets cheap and people are a little more less kind of inclined to...
You say that, but we've earned $4.1 million at the Irish box office.
It cheapens the brand for me. I don't know about everybody else.
When you use the word cheap, it sort of... I feel like the brand is doing quite strong, but I think you're right in terms of cultural conversation.
That's all I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I think that...
I mean, they'll make dollars. It's animation and it's Ireland.
Yeah.
We will flock to it.
Yeah. And I mean, that you're right that there has been a conscious shift towards doing sequels. And that's, again, the Disneyfication of Pixar.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And indeed, like, the whole situation, I believe, with Disney buying Pixar arose because the Toy Story 2, the Toy Story sequel, where Pixar were like, hey, we promised you eight films, we made you eight films, and Disney were like, one of them was a sequel, that doesn't count as a real film. And Pixar were like, wait, and Disney were like, okay, we'll buy you. That was apparently, as I understand it, how it
went. Good lord.
At number six, Hotel Transylvania 3, A Monster Vacation, at 1.6 million at the Irish box office to date.
I haven't seen it.
At number five, it's The Meg.
I still haven't seen it.
No, I went to another film on the list instead of this on Monday. But yeah, don't know how well that suited.
Oh, I did it. Did it smell fishy? Did it?
Oof.
No. Bad. Okay, fine. But it's hardly sinking at the Irish box office.
It's actually doing quite well across the board, actually, I think.
It's
initially there was kind of real fear that it wasn't going to do
that's
anything.
That's it, exactly. There was a lot of pessimism.
Hey!
Let's see what you did there.
He likes it when he does this.
Yeah, I do. I don't, actually. I'm actually appalled by myself.
But yeah, it was tracking surprisingly low, and everybody was very worried about it, and particularly when the reviews came out, and everybody was like negative, and they're like, what? This is, you know, this could really sink Jason Statham. Yeah. And then they were like, nope.
He is unsinkable.
It's unsinkable.
It's time for Crank 3.
It is time for Crank 3.
It is long past time.
Like, we're on the third John Wick sequel, for Christ's sake. Crank films are miles better than John Wick films.
What you're saying is they should crank it out, eh?
I would watch another three or four Crank films. No better.
Gladly.
At number four, I suspect this might have been the movie that Alex went to see. It's The Equalizer 2.
Yes.
The Sequalizer.
The Sequalizer. I also went to go see it in 4DX.
Why? You keep doing this.
So here's the thing. There's a few people, you know, I work with, and we go to the cinema every now and again. And they all wanted to go to Ant-Man, which I had accidentally seen the previous week. So I shot myself in the foot and said, let's go see The Equalizer. The only one screening was the 4DX one. We ended up going. It's a weird film to see in 4DX.
It's not really one that he can
not one, not at all. It's, for the most part, the seats vibrate when he's in a car, like you're in a car.
That has not an effect on
Denzel Washington's footsteps rumble the cinema. And then the last half hour, which is
in the middle of a storm,
set in a hurricane, makes you feel like you're in a hurricane. I was soaking wet. I was cold. The seats were like going back and forth. I just wanted the film to end. Yeah. Did not add to my enjoyment of what I should also say is not a great film anyway.
No, I don't think
even outside of 4DX, not a great film.
No, it is not at all.
It's all over the place.
It's too slow.
It doesn't really know where it's going.
It knows where it's going. It's like, we're going to get to the point where he's both the old man and the sea. Like,
literally.
There's a point where they have a conversation where they're listening to the radio, like, oh, this storm is coming in pretty slow. And you're like, oh, I see what you think you're doing, movie.
And it's annoying because, I haven't seen the first one.
Could you follow it?
I could follow it well enough. But it opens on a train.
Yes,
and
in the Orient Express.
In the Orient Express, and Denzel's in disguise, and he's killing Turkish mobsters and bringing kids home. And I was like, I am on board for this.
I don't know what happened at the end of the first one that would set that open.
Exactly. I've found that out since.
That was my big surprise watching it as well. It was like,
he's become Tom Cruise?
Yeah.
It's like, what?
But I was really excited, and then it immediately goes back to... American City.
That's the weird thing about it is that it wants to be this international, like, mystery sort of espionage thriller, and also wants to retain this gritty urban drama. The first one. So you have moments where he literally commutes from solving a murder in Brussels to coming home to teach a young man the importance of being his own self.
Which includes pointing a gun at him and, like, insisting he read Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, which was another, like,
a very mixed message. Yeah,
a weird film in
it's
parts.
It's a very strange movie.
It sounds bonkers.
I actually saw the first one again last week, and I'm with it for the climax, which is Die Hard and DIY Store.
Okay,
I think that's all right. Actually, yeah, not wrong.
I think
starting to sober up. Actually,
Denzel's really, like, I'd watch him do almost anything. That's kind of why I went to this film.
Denzel's great.
Yeah,
he'd nearly get me to the cinema for anything. He's like, well, I won't. But Denzel's in it.
It's just so disappointing. This was such a misstep.
So
it could have been good.
It's dreary and it's lifeless.
I like the last one they did, the Magnificent Seven remake. I'm not a fan of remakes, but I actually thought, you know what, this is stupid and fun. And
I saw it on a plane. It was okay.
And still felt trapped.
It was all, and I was okay. Yeah. It's just Chris Pratt.
Number three, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
Woo.
Oh, yeah.
Which is now in the top 10 of all time at the Irish box office, right?
Yeah, and gaining.
Really?
Like, it's going to climb. Like, I mean,
the
first one's at four.
I was going to say, what's the top three or four of the Irish top 10?
I don't know off
the top. Mamma Mia's got to be up there,
number
four.
It is number four.
With, I think, about 6.5 million.
Yeah, the
Mamma Mia films are
Jurassic World, I suspect, maybe up there.
Like they do well pretty much everywhere, but
they get people who haven't gone to the cinema in years to go because there's the effect of the ABBA nostalgia, the star draw, the word of mouth, and I think the repeat viewings are a huge
part of this.
Do you want to count down the top four movies of the Irish box office? Surprising absolutely nobody. At number four, it's Mamma Mia. At number three, it's Star Wars, The Force Awakens. At number two, it's Titanic. At number one, it's Avatar. Yeah, yep. Okay. At number five is The Dark Knight. At number six is The Simpsons Movie. At number seven is Skyfall. We like our comedies. Mm. At number eight is Toy Story 3. At number nine is Shrek the Third. And at number 10 is The Dark Knight Rises. So it's not a bad top 10 as far as those things go. I think it's got the right apportioning of...
Let's get Mamma Mia 2 in there and we can talk again. What's Dark Knight Rises at?
I simply need to see it again.
Oh, okay. Dark Knight Rises is at 5.4, so it's probably well done at this stage.
Yes! Excellent.
That makes me happy.
Excellent.
Sorry, Darren.
Come on, Pierce.
At number 2, it's Black Klansman.
Yes, which I saw as well this week, my only cinema visit post-holiday. I really, really liked it. Has everybody seen it?
Yeah. I haven't made it yet, no.
No, okay.
Spoilers, it may not end particularly happily in terms of race relations in America.
I don't know if that's spoilers, in which we're living in the world right now.
Yeah.
Like, it's if you're a Spike Lee fan, you'll probably have a good idea what to expect if you've seen X amount of his films, Malcolm X amount of his films, you will. It's an extremely smart script, and Lee doesn't get enough credit for his technical skills as a filmmaker, and how he puts stuff together. Never seems to focus on that in reviews a lot of the time.
Well, that's because there's so much else going on.
Yeah, no,
it's impossible to talk about a Spike. I feel like if you're talking about a Spike Lee film and you're talking about the technical accomplishments, you're immediately going to get a point of.
But, I know, but I think at this stage, I think a bit of credit is due. He dazzles in this film visually, really well put together. Denzel Washington's son, whose name is something Washington?
Michael David, is it?
I'm going to say John Michael.
John David.
it's one of the combinations
of those two.
Is excellent. Yeah. And does a My Man.
Yeah.
In the Denzel way in the film, which is...
But crucially, different.
He definitely is. He's great, softer, kind of nicer guy of Denzel.
It's really weird, because he doesn't really look that much like Denzel when you're sort of looking right at him. But again, it's like the Charlie Buscemi role. It's if you close your eyes.
Wait.
If you were to close your eyes and watch the audio description version of Black Klansman, it would sound like it's Denzel Washington and Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, wow, this is like the movie that he made in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's great. It's kind of one of those films that Lee throws everything at it. And it's that kind of righteous anger, kind of funny. There's almost kind of slapstick elements to it nearly. It's weird. It's... The first half hour is sensational. It's this introduction to the world. It's incredible. It kind of meanders around a bit for about an hour. There's still great stuff in it, but it kind of loses a little bit of focus in the middle, I thought, for me, before kind of pulling together for an outstanding finish and a gut punch of an ending. And I kind of it's the first Spike Lee film I've seen in the cinema in quite a few years. And immediately after finishing, I was like,
well, I mean, Chirac didn't get a release.
No, I saw that at home, which I really liked as well. So, return to form stuff is a bit nonsensical. But the Lee gets that a lot as well. It's quite prolific as well, so I think there's a lot of that. Mm-hmm. But I remember there's quite a film called I Want to See More Spike Lee Films in the Cinema because they're a treat.
They're cinematic.
He's a really cinematic filmmaker, and he knows what plays. And there's a sledgehammer in this film. It's like, people aren't listening.
More than one,
yeah. But people aren't listening to just kind of, nice kind of conversations. That's not going to fly anymore. It's just not going to fly. So he just takes a hammer to everything.
Interesting, because I would argue that it actually, as much as... And again, one of the criticisms I get from people like Boots Riley is that it's not, sledgehammery enough.
Yeah.
I
disagree.
I think it's very measured for, the situation we're in and for Lee's... sort of persona as a righteously justifiably
I know I understand that but it being and but I think to some degree and in terms of the Boots Riley kind of criticisms or whatever, I think we're talking about two different things. I think the sledgehammer approach is a racial one where it's clear and it's a political one rather than necessarily a filmic kind of thing he's getting at. the characters serve the story, and there's police characters, and this is what we're reading. Yeah. It's like that there can be honourable police characters. And I think Lee is smart enough to know that if you want the film to kind of go over,
yes,
you got to
play
have
with
a certain,
an audience, yes.
You got to have a certain play that is a little more subtle, and that's perhaps the only subtle thing in the film in that regard. But I think politically, he absolutely goes for it. Like, and lest you didn't know exactly what he was saying, the coda is there to expressly tell you exactly what he's saying, even if it's quite clear. There's a really interesting conversation, a really obvious one to some degree, earlier
with him
on
and
film,
his superior.
Yeah, where he talks about, like, you know,
David
Duke
attempted
as a,
political
you know,
influence.
Who, you know, he could become president one day. He's like,
or somebody
and
like
he just starts to laugh. He's like, nobody would vote like David Duke as a president. It's like, what are you talking about? It's like, you know, and it's clear. Like,
for a black man, you're
clear.
Very naive.
Yeah, exactly. And it's exactly that. And the coda exactly explicitly links the film to it, like it with real life footage, and says, like, what the hell are you talking about, America? This is exactly what we've got. This is exactly what we have. And it's your fault. this is it. Like,
I think the code is incredibly important, because what we were talking about last week, Darren, was that he sort of almost measured some of the things to sort of make it possibly more palatable to a wider audience, which is interesting. But then I think with that coda, it's just so much more powerful.
Lest you miss the underlying kind of stuff here. Yeah. No, I'm afraid not. This is exactly
where we are right now.
To the point where the actual footage he chose and everything is extremely sort of gut-wrenching and very sad and everything. And so it's... Yeah, I think what we were talking about last week in the last episode about it, sort of possibly there's some scenes that are kind of, particularly there's a scene at the end where, shall we say, he and his white colleagues all do something together that didn't exactly ring
feel
true.
Feel genuine
or, are we
in
talking
the context.
About the trap?
Yeah.
I know, I agree. But that almost had a Scooby-Doo ending, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and which...
But then
but
the real,
that,
the real
that,
mask
that,
is then pulled even further.
But that's exactly it. My mind, that scene was actually almost like make-believe. Like, it was almost a...
A taxi driver ending. Everything's fine.
Yeah, I
got
that.
Back in the car.
It was like, in a happily ever after, this is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Hang on a second, this is what actually happened.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. That's what I read it like.
Yeah.
Because it's so clunkily done that Lee is too smart a filmmaker to do that.
Yeah.
Accidentally or...
No, and that's what
we
were...
To be able to read his own kind of filmmaking skill. Like.
Yeah, right.
Cool. It's incredibly odd. It's like, yeah. No, it's this.
And at number one, it's Christopher Robin.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
What?
I have not seen this yet. This is the Disney one. This is the dueling Christopher Robin movies.
No.
This is the Hugh McGregor one.
Is it dueling?
There was
remix.
Goodbye Christopher Robin with Donald Gleason.
This
the
is two Christopher...
Yeah.
Who the fuck made two Christopher...
Disney.
Yeah. No, Fox made one of them, but now, after The Burger goes through, Disney will have made two
Is this Armageddon or Deep Impact, then,
this would seem to be the Armageddon, based on the box.
I might go see this one, then.
Who directed these? Go and tell me.
This is Mark Foster.
Oh, I'm out.
Yeah. I'm director out. Of Quantum of Solace.
Quantum of
Solace. And Finding Neverland.
Yeah. No.
One suspects Finding Neverland may or may not have been the more relevant film in this example. Also, World War Z, after Fincher dropped out.
Okay.
I still hear that he's possibly going to direct the second one. I imagine that's just him being nice to Brad Pitt after his divorce. I'm there for you. Whatever you need.
Just call me. Well, I have a film that I really like you to direct. Let's move on to the new releases. So out this week, new releases include Yardie, directed by Idris Elba.
Oh, yeah.
Which I haven't seen. I'm quite looking forward to seeing.
Seen a few posters and stuff.
Can I just mention about this, right? I like Idris Elba, and this film looks interesting enough, but the trailer for the film is really... The trailer I saw was really strange, and this seems to become a thing where somebody talks over film to tell you what they were thinking of doing it.
Yeah.
What?
Idris Elba introduces the film.
Oh. Yeah.
And you see him, and then he starts... And he shows you clips of it.
Yeah.
And he says, what we're trying to do here, and it's like...
I like this film.
What the fuck
film
is going on?
With Idris Elba.
But it's like, please watch my film vibe off it, which is like...
This
nothing
is like
says
Celia
stinker
Emery.
Like that. And it always worries me when somebody, and you know when you get that, you know, hi, I'm Amy Poehler, please see my film. It's starting in Dublin this week. It's like, yeah, I'm not seeing that film.
Yeah.
You know, there's that kind of thing. And I like it with Elba.
Should be fair, Elba is the biggest name associated with Yardie. Is, I suspect, an issue with the marketing.
Oh, no, sure.
It's not like...
What I'm saying is I'm not sure this helps.
No.
Like,
I feel
you
like
plaster him on a poster rather than have him talking in the cinema.
I feel like it would be even more disingenuous for a bunch of people to show up for the movie Yardie with an Idris Elba poster and be like, directed by Idris Elba.
I don't know how you pitch it. Maybe
the poster is him with a camera.
I just don't like the idea. I'm not a big fan of the people talking to me in the film.
Oh, no.
Hey, audience. It's like, dude, you're not even here. So shut up.
Aren't you my friend, Jay? Yeah.
No, stop that, please. Hollywood, stop it.
I am wary of that as well, but I still remain. I suspect that's more like a necessity than.
No, I hope it's not. I like it.
I hope it's more of a necessity than a reality. Also out this week, Ida Lore's, the documentary.
I saw a trailer for this before Black Answer, and this looks like I'm kind of trying. I was talking to Ronan briefly about kind of swearing off IRA documentaries because there seems to be a ton of them. like, this is way beyond
statute
Armageddon.
Limitations is running out.
But it was like, I was like, yeah, I'm going to stay out. And then I saw the trailer for this before Black Handsman, and the trailer looks really bloody interesting.
Mm,
yeah.
I've
like, the idea
I'm
of the
kind of
interviews be broadcast after somebody died and where you can actually speak freely and stuff like that sounds really a lovely idea to hang a documentary on. Mm. So I'll probably get to see this.
Also out this week is Cold War, directed by Paul Pawlowski.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. Ida was great.
Ida was pretty great and short.
Yeah.
But this is very short as well. It's 84 minutes long.
Ooh. Done.
That's how you make a film, people. Yeah.
And I think Donald Clark has described it as one of his favorite films of the year so far.
Yeah,
so
I'm sad. I really like that. Can't wait to see it.
Speaking of some of the best films of the year so far, also out this week, Action Point. Johnny Knoxville's shared universe of Bad Grandpa.
What?
Oh no.
This is the one where Bad Grandpa has a flashback to when he worked at a theme park in the 70s,
when you
could do stuff like ignore health and safety regulations.
Terrible title.
Oh, is Bad Grandpa bankable enough to hang a shared universe off?
Who saw Bad Grandpa?
Lots of people, apparently.
Darren? Who saw Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa?
Don't look at me like that.
You've seen everything.
Don't judge me.
Have you seen Bad Grandpa?
I have not seen Bad Grandpa.
Genuinely surprised.
I'm stunned. I'm actually stunned.
I have seen the Jackass films, but I've not seen
this Knoxville stick of like throwing himself off things is still going.
Well, this is the thing.
20 years.
Ironically,
it must be like 50.
Yeah, well, that's it. I feel like this feels like a step back. I haven't seen Bad Grandpa, but this feels like a step backwards from Bad Grandpa because Bad Grandpa was like Johnny Knoxville in prosthetics being offensive.
Don't give Spike Jonze enough like grief.
I was worried you were going to take credit for his involvement there. But yeah, this is very much in the Jackass vein. It's like, watch these people do crazy stunts. It feels like it's a roll backwards. It's like, okay, you can do your acting thing, Johnny Knoxville, but we also want to see you get hurt. And it's like, okay, fine, I'll do it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a very, very...
Feels
very
like a relic at this point.
Yeah.
Also out this week, the Ballymurphy Precedent, which I know next to nothing about.
What is that?
Ballymurphy Precedent.
The details in our database are not particularly...
Sounds like a legal
illuminating.
Yeah.
That's not a film, there. I've got a company predict.
Is Ballymurphy a real place?
We'll be back next week with some answers.
What a cliffhanger.
Also, also out this week, and one of the worst films I've seen this year... Wow. The Happy Time Murders.
Oh.
Darren has seen this, so you don't have to.
Yeah.
I recently like reported, you know the way Twitter has like ads now in between tweets?
Yeah.
I got so many Happy Time Murder like trailers that were so profoundly disgusting and depressing that I just sort of like said I don't want to see these anymore. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're playing them on YouTube. I mean, Niall, who runs the sort of Scandal website, he has young kids who are watching stuff on YouTube, and the Happy Time Murders are being queued up between the stuff that they're watching.
Because 2-year-olds love
puppets, right?
Yeah, right.
I think it's like Brian Henson, though, which
it
makes
is,
it
yeah.
worse.
Which
the legacy,
which makes it depressing.
Like,
it's Henson Alternative is the brand that it's released under, or Ha for the kids.
How dare he?
It's not even that. I mean, you could accept it if it were good.
Okay.
Like, but this is like, this has a puppet sex scene, which is by definition the third best puppet sex scene of the 2010s, if only because, or 2000s, because there's only been three of them. Mm-hmm. It's something that would have been transgressive to do 20 years ago, but now just feels lame and tired. It's a comedy without any jokes in it. It's a film noir homage without any understanding of what made film noir work.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
That's it, exactly. It tries to do this really awful racial commentary in there, but it's so shallow that it's horrifically misjudged. The human cast is horribly underused. You've got Elizabeth Banks in there, Melissa McCarthy, Maya Rudolph. And it's just a disaster. And it's a disaster that's boring and dull.
So not even a cult possibility.
It's not even it's spectacularly ill-judged. And it's just horrific. Really,
I will not be going to see
it. I will not go to see
it. Really horrific. Also out this week, Searching. Starring John Chu, directed by Anish Chaganti, who directed the Google advertisements that people really liked. Yeah, he directed those advertisements for Google a couple of years ago.
Hang on a second. Are you pitching a film to me from the guy that directed the Google advertisements, Darren?
Is this the one where they, like, search?
Yep, and it shows you as they're going, and it's, like, basically...
I'm too old.
They were quite good.
I'm
too old, going too young.
They were clever in that sort of, like, Don Draper...
This is selling you a dream sort of thing. It's like, what is Google to you?
Why does Google need to advertise?
just
to make sure AltaVista is well and truly dead. Yeah. No one's binging things anymore.
Where's my Yahoo? Ask Jeeves. What do I do with this?
Yeah,
does Spider-Man still Bing search?
We discovered that people were using Bing as a verb in several small markets, and we needed to crush them. Yeah. Searching is actually surprisingly fun. It's a trashy, sort of pulpy movie about a man whose daughter disappears, and so he embarks on a quest to find her, and he does that by searching through her Facebook history.
Does this all also happen on the screen?
It does indeed. It's very much, it's like Unfriended, but Unfriended you could show your grandparents. It's this weird sort of hybrid of like that laptop screen style of storytelling with more conventional film cues. So for example, the camera moves around the screen, drawing your attention and focus to things on the screen that you should be looking at. It has diegetic music. It's got like this interesting, like it's this weird sort of halfway marker between these experimental sort of like Unfriended films and something more accessible and family friendly. And it's kind of interesting to watch in those terms. It's also a really trashy sort of like kind of thriller about it's Taken but with a laptop. And it works. There are points. It's got good jokes. It's got reasonably clever understanding of how the internet works. It's got this idea of like paranoia that brews when you do stuff online and how like the internet and the connections that it creates lead you to these horrible conclusions and to wrong conclusions and to make mistakes in ways that don't really work. And it sort of works in that way. I mean, it's fun.
I won't like it, all right?
No, it may be too hip for the kids.
I will say that I interviewed John Cho once, and he was lovely. So I will always say that.
I look up that interview instead.
Yeah.
His interviews are fantastic. He did one with Vulture this week, which was also very, very cool as well.
He's a very like open, very cool, very nice guy.
Also out this week, Upgrade.
Oh yeah, you'd seen. I've heard
good
things.
I've seen this a couple of times. It's really good. I really enjoyed it in a sort of a trashy B movie sort of way. It's Lee Wennell, who is one half of the team that directed the first Saw. He's not the half who's directing Aquaman, The Fast and the Furious 8, or the Conjuring movies.
Jesus, that's a busy guy.
No, he's not that half. Lee Wannell is the other half. He's the Australian guy who's much more interested in doing weird stuff, and this is very much in your 80s sort of like low budget B movie sort of way, in that like there's a fancy future car but there's only one of them because that's as far as the budget will stretch sort of logic behind I really enjoy this. It's trashy, it's pulpy, it's fun, it's got this sort of inventive style, and it understands how body horror works, which is this idea that your body is like terrifying.
Turning on you.
So that's it. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, if people want to a bit more Ronan, Alex, or Jay in their lives, where can they find you guys?
At Jay Cohen on Twitter.
I run a podcast called When Irish Eyes Are Watching, and we'll be doing Black 47 soon, hopefully.
Oh.
I'm on Twitter at Baron Ronan, banging on about Irish queer cinema in Sin Erin, and I am soon to be guesting on the Habitus podcast talking about Sally Potter's Orlando.
Oh.
And I also run a podcast, The 250, looking at the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time, where this week we will be discussing Peter Bogdanovich's Paper Moon, which is beautiful film.
Mm-hmm.
Not to spoil the podcast, but I've
never seen it.
Wonderful. You now have the perfect podcast to keep you company after you do.
Yeah.
You can follow me online at Darren_Mooney. You can follow the podcast at @the250. You can follow Scannon at @scannon and visit us at scannon.com. Take it easy, guys. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.